Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Sean Burns from Outlier.ai coming to us from Oakland. How's your day going, Sean?
It's going well. It's going well.
Now, I'm in San Francisco right by the Presidio, and it's foggy and cold here. Do you guys get sun over in Oakland, or are you in the overcast as well?
No, we are overcast, although I find Oakland is a little bit nicer. I refer to Oakland as the less unaffordable side of the Bay Area because San Francisco's gotten so amazingly unaffordable for everyone. And so Oakland, when I moved here 10 years ago, was a great affordable alternative, and now it's just less unaffordable. So
less unaffordable.
All the same weather, all the same things, just a little bit cheaper.
Well, you know, my sister used to live in Emeryville, and they had this, again, this is about 10 years ago, they had this amazing, massive industrial loft that they weren't paying very much for. And every now and then we'd have the fog here and the fog would just stop right about Berkeley-ish and they'd have sun, you know, these microclimates in the Bay.
Oh, most days it is sunny over here. Don't get me wrong. The fog typically doesn't make it across the Bay. It is nice.
Good for you. Okay, awesome. Well, let's jump right into it. So what is Outlier.ai? Tell us what you guys do.
Yeah, so we use artificial intelligence to automate the process of business analysis. And so most companies today have so much data. It comes out of everything that they do. It comes out of your sales process or your marketing. It comes out of your payment systems, your accounting systems, and your databases. Everything is just generating so much data that a lot of companies, the hardest problem they have is not really knowing where to look. What do you look for in the data? How do you find those emerging problems, that emerging opportunity? And especially most of our customers are going to be large enterprise consumer businesses. So airlines, travel companies, or large CPG brands, or large e-commerce providers, where understanding consumer behavior as it's starting to change is critical. Because if you find out a month or a quarter later, there's nothing you can do about it. And so by using artificial intelligence, Outlier can do what an army of business analysts would be required to do, which is look through all that data, find those subtle changes, the shifts, those patterns, and bring them to the attention of people who need to know. So the executives or the operations folks. And so it's been very interesting to watch that, you know, 3 years ago, a company's about 3.5 years old, and I would explain the use of AI to do this business analysis. I used to get funny looks, and people would say, yeah, I don't know. It sounds like science fiction. I don't think software can analyze a business like a person. But even if it could, this is not a problem that I have. I have my dashboards on the wall. They tell me my revenue. They tell me my users. In 2018, it changed. People are actively looking for solutions like Outlier because they realize the market's so competitive that your dashboard is only telling you what you know. It's already telling you what you're already new to look for. And that's not good enough anymore, right? Knowing what those opportunities and those blind spots is critical. And so Outlier has become very popular as also people begin to accept artificial intelligence as a real technology platform that's changing the way that we do business. So it's exciting to watch, you know, 3.5 years in that the market shifted so much in our direction. And we were named a 2017 Cool Vendor in Analytics by Gartner as part of this big wave of AI taking over analytics and business decision making to the future. So it's exciting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what are some of the most common or popular use cases or even just a couple scenarios? You mentioned like airlines or consumer goods companies. What are they sort of
doing? So these are the kind of companies that have tens of millions of consumer touch points a day. And so what are they looking for with Outlier? Well, typically we're deployed in a few ways. One is the marketing department. They want to understand how all the marketing spend they have is not just generating people to their website or to their app, but how is it resulting in revenue? How is that related to customer support requests? Are there certain campaigns that people just can't figure out how to work? Or are they attracting the right kind of people that are actually converting into long-term revenue? We also get deployed against the product teams who are trying to do, they're doing dozens of A/B tests. They want to understand the inadvertent side effects of changes, right? You may make a change in your website with the goal of driving more purchases, but what about that customer segment that all of a sudden can't use the product the way they used to and is frustrated and goes away? So what happens in business today is so complicated, there's always going to be these secondary side effects, these hidden effects that are out there, which are important to know about, and Outlier can find them for you. We also help our customers understand when they can trust their data. So one of the great problems in business is, can you actually trust your data? Can you trust the numbers on the dashboard? And the answer is a lot of times they don't, or they just don't have enough faith that they can just blindly trust the data. And Outlier, because we're doing automated analysis of all the data every day, can actually point out where you have risk areas, where your data quality may not be 100%. And that goes all the way down the line. And so at scale, when Outlier is deployed with our customers, there's usually dozens of people that are using Outlier in slightly different ways because it can be personalized down to the individual user. So for example, a marketing operations manager would have a different experience than an account manager, who would have a different experience than the CMO, who has a different experience than the CEO. Because everyone in the organization has slightly different needs. Like, what kind of insights do they need to do their job more effectively? Well, the CEO needs to find longer term shifts, big patterns in the market. Whereas the marketing operations manager needs to understand the effectiveness of specific campaigns. And the account manager needs to understand how these two dozen accounts are working and operating and changing.
It sounds really cool. It sounds amazing. Isn't the...
Thank you.
Isn't the sort of, I don't know, parameter or limitation around AI is, you know, it's only as effective as how you set it up and train it to learn. I mean, it sounds like the things these are tackling would be a very heavy setup cost. Does this take a long time to kind of implement? And
No, it takes 15 minutes to get set up. Actually, it's just a few clicks to get going. Our largest customer is one of the big newspaper conglomerates here in the US, and they integrated their whole data warehouse in less than 10 to 15 minutes. So it's very fast to do that. I think the reason it's fast and the reason we bypass a lot of the problems you're mentioning, because you're right, and a lot of machine learning and AI, if you don't train it on good data, if you don't train it well, it just can give you gibberish. The benefit that Outlier has is these companies we're working with have years of data already in these systems. So the system can already go through and look at things like seasonality patterns, business cycles, trends. There's a lot of existing data sitting there. Because if you're a large Fortune 500 consumer company, you have years of data about your customers. You just haven't been using it very effectively to date in many cases. And so there's a lot of data to be trained on. The second problem about training it well, it is hard. I mean, we have a system that uses about 15 different forms of machine learning from beginning to end to produce results. And it requires a lot of expertise to be able to manage the system and have it do it essentially its own unsupervised training of itself. But that's, you know, what took us about 3 years to get up and running here at the company. It is short. It's most companies, you may be able to get to an MVP in 6 months, maybe 9 months. This kind of product takes a few years for that reason, that you have to spend a lot of time refining it.
Okay, that's interesting. And so, where'd this come from? What were you doing before? You know, were you guys working in a big consumer product group in the data group, or what was the genesis?
Yeah. So I've been an entrepreneur for a long time. I started a company called Flurry back in 2005, which we grew 9 years to being one of the largest analytics and advertising companies for mobile. We did analytics and ads for iOS, Android apps. We had we were one of the biggest data companies in the world. We had about 500,000 customers around the world. So I got to travel the world meeting all sorts of businesses, many of these businesses, these large consumer businesses, obviously, as mobile became the dominant platform. We sold it to Yahoo in 2014, and I took a year off and kind of started this a year after. And the impetus for this was kind of funny. I would travel the world meeting as many customers of Flurry as I could. And one of the interesting things that I always noticed was I got the same question wherever I went, no matter where I went, from what it kind of, doesn't matter what kind of company it was or how big it was, the question was always the same. It's like, Sean, what do I look for in all this data? You're giving me so much data, that's great, but what do I look for in all of it? And after a while, I just realized it was the definitive problem of the next 10 years. If the past 10 years about BI were about answering questions I had, like how much revenue do I have? That's largely a solved problem. The next 10 years was about asking better questions. And that's where Outlier came about. And the reason we ended up having to use AI was, you know, I didn't set out to start an AI company. I set it out to start a company that would help people ask better questions. It turned out the only way to do that was to have a system that could look through the data comprehensively in ways humans couldn't. And the only technology that allowed us to do that was machine learning and artificial intelligence. And before that, by the way, I went to grad school for artificial intelligence or machine learning about 20 years ago. And we used to joke back then that what we were working on was not going to be useful in our lifetimes, that it was going to be like another generation before we're doing. And lo and behold, I just had to wait 20 years and it was going to come home for me. And I looked like a genius for having gone to school for this 20 years ago.
Yeah. I don't remember them offering it when I was in school, but yeah, I might've just missed it. That's cool. That's really interesting. And I noticed, I watched a little video beforehand, you guys deliver, instead of the dashboard, at least part of the video pitch was, instead of the dashboard, you'll deliver me an email every morning with a few kind of action items or insights, right? Is that?
That's right. You spend a few minutes setting it up, and then you can every day in your inbox get an update, a series of insights personalized for you out of the system. And part of why we do that is, you know, AI still seems new and somewhat scary to a lot of people. And so we want to make sure we fit into their day in a familiar way. We don't want to be yet another website you have to remember to log into. And so everybody loves to get the email because then you can check that on your way to work. Maybe you're on the bus or on the train. And by the time you get to the office, you know what's going on and what you need to know. So that's one reason. I think the second reason is that, you know, I think if you're building a company that needs to scale, you have to think a lot about your sales process. Because if you have a product that requires a specific workflow or has to be used in a specific way, you're limiting yourselves to customers that work in that way or can use it that way. Whereas with Outlier, if we can fit into anybody's workflow, and email is a great way to do that, then you really have no limit on who you can go after and who you can sell to. So a lot of it is both a practical but also a strategic decision that if you reach people in ways that are very easily consumed by them, you can win. Now, it isn't that simple, right? It's not, you can't just send somebody an email. It's a comprehensive experience about, you know, what is in it, how do you optimize for it, those kinds of things. But it's proven to be a huge strength for us.
I noticed this, I guess, a little bit of a parallel. I mean, I've been using Google Analytics for forever, right? And it's almost always been just overwhelming to me. And every now and then I'll sit down and like really analyze stuff. But like half the time it's like overwhelming. And now I notice they have a little section that's like the insights, your Facebook marketing is performing less than average, or your customer loyalty is increasing. Like, it's actually kind of interesting. And that is what I pay attention to now, right? It's like, mm-hmm. It's digesting all the analytics and it's cool. So,
and that's exactly what we provide for large enterprises across all their data sources. And you're right. I think what the existing providers like Google Analytics realize that you can't sell a forest of numbers anymore. You have to sell a map for people to navigate the forest. And that's exactly the same problem we're solving for large enterprises who have dozens of databases and data warehouses and dozens of tools they use. Because frankly, if your entire business fit in Google Analytics, the Google Analytics automated insights is probably going to be good enough. You don't need Outlier. But once your data lives everywhere, like most large enterprises, that's where we came in.
All right. So let's talk about fundraising. You guys just raised your Series A, which is pretty exciting. But talk about the funding. You've been around for a few years, so talk about kind of the funding path up to the Series A. Was this bootstrapped, or what did you guys do?
Yeah, well, as I said before, I've been an entrepreneur now for many years, so I've raised many rounds of funding in my life. Outlier has had an interesting trajectory, but so before I tell you about that, you should keep in mind my personal philosophy on fundraising and my bias.
Please.
I believe in raising as little as possible because I think that's how you control your own destiny, and also controlling for the post-money valuation. Because I think a lot of people get very excited by having big valuation numbers and raising a lot of money, because it is an ego boost to say, oh, I just raised $10 million and my company is worth $40 million. And I think that sounds good, but really all you're doing is constraining yourself and reducing optionality in the future. And so I've always, even going back to the days of Flurry, we didn't raise any rounds of funding for the first 2 years of the company. Oh, and really? Now with Outlier, my goal was to get started and do the same. It turned out that there were a lot of investors of Flurry that were very interested in supporting us in the early days of Outlier. So we actually raised our first round about mid-2015. So I started the company in January 2015. About 6 months later, we raised about $1 million in the seed round of the company. And the interesting thing at that point was that our burn rate was about $200 a month.
Hmm.
I raised $1 million and my investors, I sent out my investor update saying our burn rate was 200. And I got these frantic emails back saying, oh my God, why is the burn rate so high? You're going to burn through all the money so quickly. And I was like, guys, that's $200, not $200,000.
Yeah, right.
They're like, oh, they thought I had jumped the burn rate to $200,000 because they never seen a burn rate that was measured in hundreds of dollars before.
Well, then they'll yell at you for burning too little, right? So it's either, yeah.
The point was we just weren't ready. I wasn't ready to start spending the money just because we had it. The way I thought about it was we raised that funding so that we would not be distracted by fundraising about 6 months later. Because that's the big trade-off with fundraising is when do you take the distraction of raising money? Because it's hard. It's always hard. It doesn't matter what you've done. It's always going to be hard. Versus when do you need the capital to keep growing? So for example, I could have over the course of 2015, not raised money, kept building, and then taken the distraction in 2016 when we first started our customer trials and customer testing. The problem then is if I'm distracted with fundraising, I'm not focused on the customer development, the customer learning, and so I'm not going to run as fast as I can. And so this was an opportunity to run a bit faster by raising the money before we necessarily needed it, but just not spend it and hold on to it and only spend it when we got to the point where we were planning to get to. It's also obviously, as everybody probably knows, it's better to fundraise when you don't need the money. Because if you really need the money, you're in a difficult spot, and investors can understand that. So it's always better to raise it when you don't need it, when you have more than 6 months of runway left, if not even more than that. So we did that. It turned out that the customer development went well, but we realized that it was probably going to be harder to build the first version than we thought. Because as I mentioned before, it takes a long time to refine these. Yeah. And so we ended up raising another seed round, a second seed round in late 2016, led by, the first round was led by First Round Capital. The second round was led by Homebrew, both great seed investment firms. We're very lucky. And that was another little $1 million or so that got us going. And that held us over until the Series A we just raised earlier this year, because then we had enough runway to then launch the product last year, really begin the sales process, ramp up revenue. Build the business, those kinds of things. So overall, I think, and again, it was good to raise less money at lower post-money valuations for the purpose of keeping optionality open, because then we had the option of raising a second seed round, because we hadn't raised, some of these companies I meet that have raised $5 million, $10 million seed rounds. I mean, you better really be sure where you're going, because if you don't hit that next milestone, you're done. Whereas if you raise less money like we did, yes, you do take the hit of distraction of raising more money in the future, but that is weighed against the fact that that's kind of an option that you're deciding instead of having it be decided for you.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So let me see if this is oversimplifying. The first round capital, the first million was kind of just when you're getting going. The second one, the second million, second seed round with Homebrew was immediately prior to customer development or customer trials, or right after? I'm just trying to think of like the timeline of.
I don't think there was like a single point. So yeah. when my co-founder and I started the company, I could describe to you what we do now, but all we really started with was this problem that we wanted to help people know what to look for in their data. And we really didn't know what the product looked like. Frankly, I didn't even know if you could build a product to do this. There wasn't any real metaphors or equivalents out there in the market. Mm-hmm. And so the first 6 months, my co-founder and I, we really just rented ourselves out as consultants. We went to businesses and said, give us all your data. We'll just poke through it as humans. We'll tell you what we find. And we'll see is there economic value in the unexpected, in the unknown. Mm-hmm. Do we find things that are helpful? How much is it worth to these customers? And we found that it was hugely valuable. It had enormous economic value. We still didn't know what the product looked like, so to speak. And so around when First Round Capital was leading the investment, we had a good idea of the problem was real. We just still weren't quite sure exactly how we were going to solve it.
Sure.
So we started building prototypes of products, and it took us about 5 product versions to come up with something that really did resonate, which looks roughly like what you see we offer today. So that took some time. So we started with customer development. We didn't, build, and then bring it to customers. We've always had customers in the loop of building the product from the very beginning. I think largely it's transitioned from experimenting to revenue. And mm-hmm. So when Homebrew was raising that round, we were transitioning from exploratory product development and to figuring out, okay, great. Now, how do we get people to pay us the amount of money we want to charge for this? What does it have to have then? Because I've always thought, it's fascinating when companies start to charge money, because in the early days, maybe you can or maybe you can't charge money. But at some point in the life of the company, you start charging for your product, or you start putting ads in there, or you do monetization, and it always changes things. And you always like, oh, it won't change anything. It'll be the same. It'll be fine. And it always changes things. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to, think about that as an inflection point more than, customer relationships or whatever. Because also over those last 3.5 years, who we thought we would sell to had evolved, right? We started out being assuming that we would sell to smaller businesses, because the argument was smaller businesses have fewer people, but they, and therefore Outlier can be to them like an analyst would be, that they can't hire because they just don't have the time or resources to go find them. It turned out that was not true, because a small company really has difficulty keeping up with everything they know that they need to deal. So you tell them a bunch of unknowns, they'll just look at you funny and move on, because they just don't, there's nothing they can do about it. Whereas bigger enterprises, they need those. Those unknowns are exactly where their competitive advantage might lie. It's where their efficiencies can be gained. And so big shifts like that in who we're targeting have erupted over the years. Because I think that there's a lot in product development that needs to be vision-based in terms of knowing where you're going. But there's a lot in customer development that's just trial and error. You know, put things in front of customers, it's hard to know how they're going to respond. I knew coming in that this was a problem everybody agreed that they had, for the same reason that you mentioned that you've used analytics. And you know, it was easy to get people to say, yes, this is a problem I have. That is not the same as I will pay lots of money for this. Because I found the only way you'll figure that out is to ask people for lots of money. And so customer development ends up being a largely trial and error process that we've been undergoing for the last, you know, 3.5 years.
Awesome. Would you say the Series A, though, typically for most startups, that's, you figured out customer development, you figured out product market fit, you figured out your right customer segment, and now it's just pouring fuel on the fire. Does that apply to you guys, or are you an outlier, no pun intended?
No, that was good brand fidelity. I like that. Let's keep that going. I disagree. I think that used to be true when there was a standard definition of what a Series A is, and that is just no longer true. So when I was raising the Series A for Flurry, it was the different stages were pretty clear.
Yeah.
A Series A back then, this was about 2006, 2007, was what we call a seed round today. So you were early, you had a team, you had an idea, maybe you built a product, maybe not. But the Series A was really to get you started. And the more traction you had, the better you do. But it wasn't necessarily a prerequisite. There really weren't any, there were a few seed funds, first round capital had been started, but really there weren't a lot of options for seed investing. So maybe you did angel investing. But angel investing wasn't structured. There was no angelist. And so you basically raised from a bunch of angels who were the whatever rich people you knew to get started. And then a Series B was you had a business in the market, you had traction, it was about growth, and then yada, yada, onward. Now, I think that those lines are completely washed away. There's no standards. I know people who have raised $10 million seed rounds. I know people who have raised $50 million Series A rounds. These are very different kinds of companies, though. And so the Series A for Flurry was around $4 million, which is smaller than a lot of companies' seed rounds today.
Yeah, so right.
I think a lot of it doesn't matter. I rather think about it that you measure out how you want your company to grow. And then the good news is part of why the rules have washed out is there's so many more venture investors there today than there used to be. A lot of them are very flexible. And so, for example, we raised from Ridge Ventures, which is a new fund. It's an old fund with a new name. Used to be called IDG Ventures. And their focus is what they call early Series A. And so what is early Series A? Early Series A basically means that companies that are earlier than most firms are looking for Series A investments. So maybe you have traction in the market, but not a ton of traction. You've validated what you're doing. You have the team together, maybe not the entire team, but you have enough to prove that there is something there and there's a chance to grow pretty big, which would be different than, you know, a standard quote unquote Series A firm that maybe is looking to write a $10 million or $15 million check versus the late A companies, late A funders who are writing those $20 million checks and up in these businesses. So a lot of it is more, if you know when you want to raise and how much you want to raise, you can find investors at that stage for you, which is in some ways good, in some ways bad. It's good in that you can choose your own adventure, which is nice. It used to be you had to follow this cookie cutter process.
Sure.
Which, trust me, was very frustrating. Now you can follow kind of a choose your own adventure path, but it requires you to do a lot more work to find the right investor. It's not just about the investor that wants to invest in your business. You have to find somebody who wants to invest at the stage you are at in the way that you want it to happen. Because I'll give you another example. Today, a lot of our seed rounds were all equity financings, which I know is pretty unusual, but I think that convertible notes are with caps are dangerous. Convertible notes with no caps are great. you should do that for, if you can pull that off. I did the original angel investment round for Flurry was a convertible note with no cap and just a discount off the next round. That works out. I think that works out well for everyone because the investors get a discount, so they get a clear fixed return. You don't have to choose a valuation of the company, so a lot of things go better. A convertible note with a cap on it is just a really complicated equity investment because you're choosing a valuation in the cap, and you end up in a world where not only does nobody have any idea what they own in the company because you can't figure out all the different conversions and everything, but you don't even have all the advantages of equity investment having gone through those things. And so if you're going to, you know, raise around, people will complain, well, equity investment takes longer, it's more expensive in legal fees. The reality is that's not even true anymore. Like, if you want to do a convertible note round, the law firms are going to quote you around $20,000 to do that versus $30,000 for an equity round. I mean, come on, it's not that much big of a discount. Mm-hmm. So I only do equity financings, but in that way, you know, you need to find people who want to invest in the way you want to invest. So some people only do capped convertible notes. Other people prefer only do equity investments. So you have lots of different variables you have to figure out.
No, that's actually really interesting and some good food for thought. So how did you identify the folks that you wanted to come in on the round? What was your process of building that target list, if you will?
Well, we will start out by saying that fundraising is horribly difficult. And I don't care how many times you've done it before, how much success you've had, it's always difficult. Having started, built, and sold Flurry, you'd be like, well, Sean's a second time founder. Clearly fundraising must be easy. You just snap your fingers a few times and people throw term sheets. And that's really not how it works. I do think that having had success before, it's easier to get that first meeting with investors because almost every investor will take that first meeting. Mm. And I don't want to in any way discount that. That's really nice that you can always get a first meeting, but that's where it ends. After that, you're in the same train that everybody else is in going down the pike. Uh-huh. And I think that, so as a result, what does that mean? It means you have to talk to a lot of investors to find the right ones. And so I think that, you know, there was a few dozen funds that I spoke to about our Series A. Some of them, you know, don't invest at the stage that we were, this kind of like, you know, whatever stage you might call it, or some of them have, you know, very large funds often have minimum check sizes. And again, if you're me and you're trying to limit how much money you're raising, you don't want a $20 million check. And that may be the smallest check you can feasibly write out of a $800 million fund. So there's a lot of just going through finding somebody who even is capable of investing because the mechanics line up. And then you have to find people who believe in your vision, right? Which again is a smaller subset. And then you have to find people who are ready to make an investment right now that they haven't already made an investment that quarter or they have the bandwidth to pursue it. And so it's this big funnel. That's you start with all these dozens of investors you speak to. You whittle it down based on criteria of match. You whittle it down based on interest in the vision. You whittle it down based on the availability and their ability to move quickly. And eventually you come out the other end. And it's an involved process. I think on average, it takes about 3 months. And it took us 3 months. So I guess it makes us average.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I guess... kind of answered this, but I'll just toss it around anywhere. I mean, you're mentioning, you know, you've really got to find the right investor who will do your stage and who wants to do a deal that you want to happen. So I guess, could you identify much of that in advance? Like Ridge, I didn't know they did early Series A, right? I don't know if you identified that in advance or this is something that you just have to go talk to a couple dozen firms and you sort of natural selection process. You know what I'm asking?
I understand. It would be a lot easier if firms did put on their website exactly what they invest. And in fact, it would be even easier if they put their investment process on their website so you knew the rules of engagement as well. Because every firm now has a different process. Because it used to be, you know, go back to the days of Flurry 10 years ago, if you got invited to a partnership meeting to pitch a partnership of a firm, 9 out of 10 times you're going to get a term sheet. It was basically like the end of the process. Now it's somewhere like the middle to beginning. The chances of getting a term sheet are actually less than half, which is just different. And so everybody's a different process now, which is just very disconcerting as a founder because it's much easier if everybody follows the same process. And now it's, again, choose your own adventure on both sides. So a lot of it comes down to how do you find these people? The only way, there are only two ways I've ever found that are reliable. One is to get recommendations, either from your existing investors, other friends, other founders, because once you worked with a firm, you know what they look for, you know what their process is and what stage they invest in. But it may not be possible to discern that from their website.
Yeah.
And the second is really just talking to a lot of firms, and you will have a lot of first meetings with firms that will go well, but it'll turn out that it's just not a good fit for whatever reason. And I think that, you know, if you're a first-time founder, your bias is if you get a meeting with an investor, the first meeting, you're in sell mode. You're like, sell, sell, sell. I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread. A lot of them don't catch their breath to say, great, I'm going to turn the tables and ask you some questions, right? How much of your fund is invested? How many more investments are you going to make this year? How long does it take you to make a decision? What is your process for making a decision? All these kinds of questions that you need to know. Because you find a firm with somebody who's really interested, but they've already finished investing their last fund and they're working on closing their next fund.
Yeah.
They don't actually have any money. They don't have no money to invest. Very frustrating to spend that much effort and not have qualified that up front and try to figure that out. So it ends up being really, in some ways, like customer development, where it's trial and error. I don't believe there is a fast or easy path to it. It just requires time, a lot of diligence and persistence.
Yeah. Let's drill into that a little bit more. What are some of the other questions you ask? How much have you already invested of your fund? How many more deals this year? These are good qualifier ones. What's your process like? Any other?
Let's take a step back and like think about what is the arc of a VC fund? Because it's important to know your customer. So who is, in this case, if you're selling your equity in your business, the buyer is the VC firm. VC funds typically run on 10-year cycles. So if we raise a new fund, like a $10 million, $100 million fund or something, you usually have about 3 years to invest it. And then the rest, the next 7 years, you're maintaining that portfolio. So doing follow-on investments, those kinds of things. So in those 3 years, and most funds may have, say, a 50-50 split. So 50% of the fund is for the initial investment and 50% of the fund is for the follow-on investments. So, you know, if you are the first investment out of the fund, all right, they have an enormous amount of money to go. But if you're the last investment, you're essentially left with whatever's left over from all the other investments before the next fund kicks in. Because venture investors will raise the next fund before the first fund is exhausted. And so there's an incentive, and I'm not saying people will just rush to just invest in anything to get the money out the door, but, you know, you're in the tail end of a fund, there's less flexibility typically in the capital, depending on the fund you're talking to. So you have to understand where in the life cycle of that are they. Did they just raise the fund and they started to invest it? Are they end of the 3 year investment period? What is their follow on capital structure? Like I mentioned, 50-50 is typical, but not all funds are the same. So do they have enough money to invest in you again in the future when you raise your Series B, your Series C, your Series D? Understand that those rules of engagement. You want to understand, you know, what are the expected terms of investment? I think people assume most venture investors have all the same terms, and you get a term sheet, and a term sheet, if somebody's going to invest in you, is the terms of the investment. And the terms are always more important than the amount of money in the valuation. I think as founders, we get kind of obsessed with the dollar signs on the piece of paper. Mm-hmm. But all the terms are vastly more important than the dollar signs.
Mm-hmm.
Because people, I don't know if you've never raised this venture round before, you may not realize that in your Series A, which is very early life of your company, your venture investors are asking you to agree to terms of your IPO, which sounds bananas, right? Because it sounds so far off that it should be an academic exercise. But the reality is they're asking you to agree to terms of your IPO because they know their highest leverage point is the first time they're investing in you. And that's big, the term sheets at the very early stage of investment. And if that's there, just imagine all the other stuff's there. Things like liquidation preferences, things like board structures and approval and veto rights and voting rights and drag along rights and things that I won't even get into. The terms end up becoming most important, but you should talk to investors about their terms, because if you wait until you get a term sheet to find all the horrible things they're trying to stuff in there, you wasted a lot of time. And you may find yourself in a position where you have no choice but to accept terms that you wouldn't want to otherwise accept because you didn't actually challenge them in the beginning. So there's a wide range, but roughly all the questions follow the same questions you'd ask in any sort of customer development process. Understand the customer, understand their decision-making, understand their timelines, and understand any unique aspects of how they view the world and how they buy things to be able to essentially qualify somebody. And that's true of consumer products or enterprise products. Customer development itself is really just understanding the person on the other side, understand how they make decisions, and understanding if you can navigate that, or if it's better to move on and find somebody else.
I like that. I've never really heard that put like that, kind of the VC process as customer development process in many ways. That's good. Yeah. Good stuff. Hey, not to get, you know, too in the weeds about terms, because that could be its own, you know, thing, but are there any terms that you're particularly like passionate about one way or another, like things that are deal breakers for you, or, you know, you're just the red flags for you?
Well, I will tell you, for a while, I was the term sheet coach for Velocity, which is the University of Waterloo's accelerator program. And cool. That meant that any company in the Velocity portfolio that was negotiating a term sheet, I was available to help them. I got tricked into it by a guy named Mike Kirkup, who was the head of the program, who's a great guy. You should have him on in the future.
Wait, but, what's his name?
Mike Kirkup. He's a good guy. And so I used to coach, and these are companies in Canada, and a lot of them got term sheets from VCs that are not Silicon Valley, Bay yep. Area venture investors. And the farther you get from Silicon Valley, typically the worse the terms get, frankly, for the simple reason that in Silicon Valley, the capital structure and incentives are built around long-term, large amounts of appreciation, big wins. The farther you get from here, and this isn't always true, but it's a generally true statement, that the terms get much harsher because the investors can't count on that kind of repeated gameplay that we count on out here in Silicon Valley, where people start one company, then they start another company. And I saw things in those term sheets that literally horrified me. There were things like 3x liquidation preferences, which means that the investor gets 3 times their money back before the rest of the money is divvied up among everyone, including them. So if you raise, say, a $5 million round, they would get $15 million off the top. And then you'd go through the rest of the money and divvy it up to everybody. So they get double dip. There are terms that are getting more and more popular today where investors ask for veto rights on any major company decision, which means essentially that you have created not just a board of directors, but now a shadow board of investors who have your universal veto rights to control what you're doing. So I think that there's lots of terms out there that are non-standard and somewhat frightening in how they work. So those things, I think the good news is most investors, because of in the age of AngelList and transparency around these things, there's a big incentive to have quote-unquote standard terms. And so it is going to be a rare investor that tries to introduce these weird, crazy things. And there's also a universe of people who are very savvy that will help you identify when a crazy term gets dropped in there. And so it gets easier to avoid them. You know, 10 years ago at Flurry, there was no online resources, no AngelList. It was hard to know what was normal and what was not normal. We talked to a lot of other founders, but even founders, you know, we don't have a lot of institutional knowledge as founders because we go start a company for 8 years and maybe we sell it, then we start another one. Like, you know, VCs are closing multiple rounds of funding a year.
Yeah.
Usually multiple rounds of funding, maybe even a month. And as founders, maybe we raise a dozen rounds of funding in our entire lives. Maybe 24, I don't know. It depends how much active you are. So there's a big inequality in the knowledge that the investors have versus us founders. So we have to do what we can, what we have. But it is easier today with the flexibility of knowledge and how easily that's shared.
Yeah, no, and this is part of the point of this whole show is to kind of, you know, tease out some of this locked knowledge from guys like
yourself. Next on Secrets of Fundraising.
Good stuff, good stuff. Okay, a couple more questions. I'll let you get back to your business. But did you, for the Series A, did you run a process or, I mean, it sounds like you had a funnel, you talked to these guys, or did you have a pretty clear idea of who you really wanted to get in the round?
I don't think I came in with preconceived notions in the way that I think you'd expect. I do have my general criteria for investors is pretty loose. It really is just 3.
Yeah.
It has to be someone who really understands the business that we're in. And that may sound like an obvious, easy one, but we're an artificial intelligence company. You know, artificial intelligence is very hot. There's lots of investors that have pivoted from doing something else to AI who really don't understand it, but think this is where they want to invest. And so I try to steer clear of those people. I wanted somebody who really did understand what we were doing. And the second is having someone who has a really long-term view and somebody who's been in the business for a while. And the reason is that there's weird incentives that can pop up if you're not aware of the way that your venture investor partners are thinking about stuff. So for example, I mentioned the 10-year horizon for venture funds. You know, somebody in their first fund may be really eager to have some quick exits so they can raise their next fund because they just don't have the resume, right? So I raise one fund, I want to raise my next fund, but again, if it takes 3 years just to invest the first fund and I have to raise the next fund after 3 years, most of my portfolio is still invested, right? And so there can be some people early in their career that can have interesting incentives to try to show more value, or on the alternative, they can have incentive not to sell because they want the valuations to get as high as possible. So you really want to know the rules of engagement on incentives. So someone who is who thinks long-term, who likes to build these kinds of relationships is important. And I think that the third part was someone who wanted to really be involved. I think there's a lot of funds that are just, they want to throw money at you and wish you good luck and hope you come back for in the future with more money in the form of returns. I think people who want to be involved and help is important because they become a useful resource in growing the business. And so one of the great things about Ridge Ventures, having worked with them, even before they invested, in fact, even before we really entered their process, they invited us to a summit that they run of CMOs of Fortune 500 companies to present Outlier. And out of that, we've gotten some great opportunities for customers. And that was before we were even in their fundraising process. So kind of see the fact that they would go to the effort of creating these summits to bring these executive decision makers to Silicon Valley, where I, as a startup company, can go pitch them and have access to buyers at the C level in a way that I would have almost no chance of getting on my own, was powerful. And it just it made a strong case that that is how they treat their portfolio. But that was basically my criteria. And out of that, I was very flexible in terms of who we spoke to. We spoke to some people that were like late seed investors, early A investors, full A investors, across the whole spectrum and gamut of investors that you can imagine.
No, that's insightful. That's great. You know, your third criteria was you want someone who would get involved and help. How do you, any tips for getting your investors to help? Like, do you have any formal structure? Or is it just, you know, you text them at 2 a.m. when you're having a quandary? I don't know.
Oh, no, I don't text anybody at 2 a.m. I'm asleep then. And good for you. Everybody else. I think that getting help from investors is frankly, and you're going to find this shocking, a lot like the sales process, where they will be as helpful as they are included in the process. For example, a lot of businesses, I don't know why, they don't even send monthly updates about what's going on, but I religiously send monthly updates because the more aware your investors are about what you're doing and how things have progressed, the more they will want to help because they will see what's going on. If you kind of poke up out of the blue after eight months, say, hey, by the way, I need help, they'll be like, who are you again and how do I know you?
Right. Yeah.
And then the second part is then you after a Series A, especially, you have a board, you have board meetings. A lot of founders make the mistake of making board meetings a status meeting. They show up. And by the way, venture investors love board meetings or status meetings because they save a lot of effort. They just show up and learn about what you're doing. Not all of them. I shouldn't be that general. Some of them find that very easy. Instead, the best board meetings are actually working sessions where you send out all the update materials in advance. And the board meeting itself is really discussion and debate about really important strategic decisions. And then you're getting help because they're showing up to board meetings every quarter, every few months, and they're really working for behalf of the company. And that then leads to future work where they do more work for you. People typically, and just this is a general rule in life, people will very rarely do things unless you ask them to. And that's true of venture investors as well. So overall, the best way to get investors to help you is to ask. And specifically, in a lot of ways, treat them like they're a member of your team and ask them to keep contributing in certain ways. And essentially have measurable follow-ups to say, are they doing what they said they would do?
Yeah. That's great. No, that's really great. I think that's something that a lot of funders don't leverage their investors to the point that they should. So that's some good.
Well, the investors encourage that, right? So there's a lot in the investor relationship where the founder feels like they constantly have to win the approval of the venture investor. That gives the venture investor all the power in the relationship. And in a world of venture where money has really no differentiation of any kind, that dynamic is important for a lot of investors. It becomes how they control how things are going. Whereas it takes a lot of self-confidence to turn the tables and say, no, you're not trying to, I'm not trying to win your approval. You're working for me now, right? You invest in this company. We're now tied up. I'm running the ship. I'm the CEO. And now we're going to work together and I need you to help. I need you to actively work to make sure our investment has the biggest return. But the best CEOs and the best founders make that shift because you have to.
Yeah, no, that's really important. Very good. All right. Let's see, maybe one or two more questions. Any other tips we haven't covered or anything if you rewound the clock you would do differently or any other notable things that are different from raising money now versus flurry days? Kind of a
open-ended question. We have three more hours to get to cover all that. Let's see. In reverse order, there's a lot of things that are different, but that's not super important. I'll say this, that you should keep in mind the rules are always changing.
Yeah.
Even if you raise a round of funding previously, there's no guarantee it'll work the same way today. For example, there's a lot of people who raise a seed round of funding and they thought, hey, that wasn't that bad. I picked a valuation. I created a convertible note with a cap. I went around finding people and to invest. And it took me 3 or 4 months. I did a rolling close and I got it all in. Well, a Series A will be similar. Nope. Totally different. Series A, got to find a lead investor. And so you have to always assume the world will be different or have changed versus what you expect. Or sometimes it'll be a macroeconomic cycle. I mean, I lived through the financial meltdown in 2008 in the venture community where venture funds stopped investing, period, full stop. And so the world can change in a dime and the rules can change. So expect the rules to change as you're fundraising. The second piece of advice would be it is hard to fundraise. Like I said before, even if you've done it before, it's always hard. It, for some reason, will always take twice as long as you think it will. Even when you take your initial estimate and double it, it'll take twice that long. I don't know how that preservation of longer than you expect or something like that.
Right.
It's always difficult. So don't pretend like you can do other things. Because if you're not focused on fundraising as a full-time job, it will just drag out forever.
Yeah.
To focus on, this is your job for 3 months to go out there and raise money. And you probably will do very little else during that period, which is why it's such a big distraction. And at some point you'll get frustrated and wonder why everybody else can raise $10 million when you're struggling to raise five, or everybody else can raise 50 when you can't get 10. And it's very easy to read TechCrunch too much and believe that you're not good at fundraising. And I will just tell you right now, fundraising is hard for everyone. There was an article over the weekend about Elon Musk scrambling to raise money and how difficult it is for him. And I'm like, everyone has difficulty fundraising. It's just how the system is built. So if it's difficult, it's not you. It's just difficult. It's just how it is.
Yeah.
And the third part, and this is the hardest one, is when do you know to give up? When do you know you're not going to raise money? And this is a question I get a lot from founders where I knew one founder that it took them 2 years to raise a round of funding, which is probably 18 months more than they should have spent on it because it didn't end up with a very happy ending anyway. I think that there's a point where you have to decide when you're coming in how hard it is to get there. Because we like to romanticize those stories about the founders of, you know, company X, which went on to be worth billions of dollars, every single investor turned them down. But I think that is like saying you'll win the Powerball if you play these numbers last week. It's like these things happen, but they won't happen to you. They won't happen to me. Like you can win the lottery. It does happen. It's just very, very, very unlikely. A much more realistic way to approach it is saying, you know, how much money do we need? Where can we get there? Let's time box raising money and see if we can make it happen. If we can't, then we can. If we can, then we can. I've watched founders go into mountains of credit card debt. Just believing if they had a little bit more time, they could raise more money. And in the end, all they're left with is a mountain of credit card debt. And it's really unfortunate. So I'm not saying give up, obviously, especially founders, good founders wouldn't even listen to me if I did say give up, but I would never say that. But you have to have some constraints on how hard you're willing to work and whether or not you're going to get there.
Is it 8 months, 6 months? I mean, if you're going to use time.
On average, it's three, right? So if it takes you more than six, that means you're now twice the average length of time. It's probably not going very well.
Yeah.
If it takes four or five, it's probably not going very well.
Well, this is good stuff. Great. So any last words of thought or anything you'd like to plug? If people want to learn more, it's just outlier.ai, correct?
Yeah, just check us out online, outlier.ai. We actually have a daily newsletter called the Data Driven Daily. You can sign up for it on our website, outlier.ai, where you can get a daily tip about using data to make better decisions across a wide variety of business examples and stuff. It's free knowledge about using data to make decisions. So sign up on our website for that. And follow us on Twitter. It's just at Outlier AI.
Awesome. Well, Sean, this is just great. I've got, you probably can't see it, but I've got pages and pages of notes here from all this. This is just fantastic. I really like it. This is one of the top podcasts I think I've done so far. So this is amazing. Thank you so much for your time. And love to keep up with the story and maybe catch you again after your Series B. How about that?
Sounds good. Thanks for having me. It was a great time.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.